Well, I actually came to the first four ciders, and it's interesting to see how the students have become the bosses here. It's great that some people never change, but anyway, it's always a lot of fun, and I always learn a lot, so it's kind of nice. Oh, and you know, I'm kind of getting old, and old people tend to say, you know, well, I did that 20 years ago. So if I ever say that, just slap me, okay? You are getting old. Okay. All right. So I'm supposed to talk about lower mantle heterogeneities, and I just want to give you some background on the kind of data that we use to do this, and kind of what we expect to see. And then we'll talk a little bit about the current set of models. There are some contradictions going on in the current literature, and I'll see if I can throw some light on that. Does this work? Yeah, it does. How about that? So I'm going to start off talking about travel time data. Both P and S waves. I like travel time data because you can actually plot them in different ways and get a feel for what they're actually telling you about the Earth, right? So I'm going to show you some pictures that maybe will persuade you that there are really large low shear velocity provinces in the lower mantle. You can just see in the data, right? It's very clear. So I'll be talking a lot about P and S, and as you can see, as you go to larger distances, you turn deeper and deeper, of course. And so we'll be looking at the depth dependence of how the residuals vary. Now, so one of the burning questions is, are anomalies inside the Earth just thermal, or are they thermal and chemical, or are they thermal and chemistry and phase, et cetera, et cetera? So a good question is to start off with is, how do we expect these things to vary relative to one another? So how do we expect VP and VS to vary? And of course, the easiest easiest thing to do that with is with temperature. But first of all, let me just do a little bit of math here. So most of the time, we're going to talk about shear velocity and bulk sound speed, right? And I don't know whether everybody knows what bulk sound speed is, but bulk sound speed is analogous to the shear velocity, which is rigidity divided by rho square rooted. The same for the bulk sound speed. So bulk sound speed is truly a measure of how things a squeeze, right? How they respond to squeezing. And shear velocity is truly a measure of how things respond to shearing. Whoops, I didn't want to do that. The compression velocity, if you just differentiate this equation here, then you can get this relationship between P velocity model, the shear velocity model, and the bulk sound speed model. And this little gamma thing here is just 4/3 Vs squared over Vp squared. Does anybody know what Vs squared over Vp squared should be in the mantle, roughly speaking? All right, so in a Poisson solid, Vp over Vs is root 3, right? So, and that's pretty close to what the mantle is. So this should be 1 over 3, so this should be about 4/9. Actually, it's roughly 0.40 throughout the whole mantle, right? So it's a good number, pretty much constant. So this equation tells you that a compressional velocity model is really about 40% of a shear velocity model and 60% of a bulk sound speed model, right? So compressional velocity has a lot of shear in it, right? So you should expect VP models to look quite a lot like VS models, because VS is, this is the dominant thing that's going on. This is the thing that's most moved around. And I'd like you to remember through all of this that bulk sound speed residuals should be small, right? We would expect them physically to be smaller than P velocity residuals because they really have no sensitivity to shear at all by design. So we're going to talk a lot about these kind of ratios here, d-log Vs by d-log Vp. This is just delta Vs over Vs divided by delta Vp over Vp. And you can do the same for the shear velocity versus the bulk sound speed. And these things are related to one another, right? So I haven't done any physics yet. This is just the relationships between these things. So this is the d-log Vs by d-log Vp along the bottom here. Boy, this thing is fussy. All right, I'm just going to use this. Okay, so we have this R ratio on the bottom here, and there's a magic number here, which is 2.5, and that's the point at which d log Vc by d log Vs goes negative. And that means that you have had an anticorrelation between the bulk sound speed and the shear velocity. And that is really hard to do, right? This is something that a seismologist should not take lightly, because it's very hard to explain that kind of negative correlation. It's impossible to explain with pure thermal effects. It's even impossible to explain with partial melting even, right? There's lots of things that you can think of that just won't work. So you should really think twice once you start getting into this kind of regime, because it's hard to do. Now, for thermal effects, it turns out that d log Vs by d log Vp is going to be about 1.7. We'll go over that in a minute. So we expect d log Vc by d log Vs to be about 0.25, right? So the bulk sound speed residual should be about, the bulk sound speed model should be about a quarter the size of a shear velocity model, if everything is thermal. So you can do this too. This is now versus d log Vc by d log Vp, just to see how bulk sound speed should vary with the p velocity. Again, 2.5 is the magic number. That's the point at which Vp and Vs and Vc anticorrelate. All right, and at 1.7 for thermal effects, you can see here that the bulk sound speed should be about 40% of the p velocity. Right, so I'm trying to get in your head that bulk sound speed residuals, the model should be small, and this R value, if it goes over 2.5, we're kind of in trouble, right? So is everybody clear on that? Okay, so for thermal effects, we have measurements, right? So typically you do an ultrasonic experiment and you can change the temperature and you can measure the P velocity and the shear velocity and you can calculate what R is. And this is an old slide, so it's been well used. So you can see R is typically about 1.2, right? And that you probably figured out is a lot less than you normally hear about when we talk about the Earth. And the reason for that is that ultrasonics are done at megahertz, right? And so they're very high frequency measurements. The elastic moduli are unrelaxed, essentially. And that's not what we have inside the Earth, right? So at seismic frequencies, the Earth, of course, is attenuating. And once it attenuates, the velocities become frequency dependent. And they also, there's a temperature dependence due to that, right? So attenuation is a thermally activated process, right? So if the velocities depend upon attenuation, they're also going to depend upon temperature. This was pointed out by Corrado a long time ago, 1992 or somewhere. So we have kind of an unrelaxed form which you'd get from ultrasonics, and then you have this attenuation term. And this is just the form that it takes if you're in the middle of an absorption band, right? So this is the assumption that Prem makes. It assumes that Q inside the Earth is independent of frequency over the band that we're looking at, and we're right in the middle of that band. And that means that the velocities are now going to be frequency dependent across that whole band. And that frequency dependence will depend on the magnitude of the attenuation. And this is attenuation in either compression velocity, shear velocity, or bulk sound speed, depending on which velocity we're looking at here. All right, so relaxation time is temperature dependent. So when you differentiate this with respect to temperature, you get an extra term here. And this term here contributes quite a lot to R. All right, so R now would be about 1.7. And the reason for that is because the Q effect is different for both P and S, right? So the ratio gets augmented now because the Qs are different. And then I just wrote this at the bottom here, and maybe we'll do a little bit of tomography to show how that works. All right, so what I'm interested in doing is looking at the travel times directly and trying to decide if this is reasonable, that this is thermal, right? I don't want to do any inversions yet. So we're going to do a little experiment here where I have a ray going through the Earth. And somewhere here, I have a blob, right? Now, the travel time is just the integral along the ray, 1 upon the velocity d gamma there, right? So I just integrate 1 over the velocity on the ray. So the physics here is distance equals velocity times time, right? So that should be okay. So now I differentiate this. I look at the delta t here, and I get this is equal to minus 1 upon v squared delta v d gamma. I'm going to write that like that. Okay. So now I'm going to look at this. I'm going to look at this blob here. And I'm going to say this blob is L long. And so this delta t is going to be roughly equal to minus 1 upon v delta v over v times L. Okay? All right. Now I can do this for both P and S. Right, so I can push the P wave through here. I can put in an S through here. So this could be delta T S. This would be V S. This would be Vs, and then I could do it and you can see what's going to happen if I take the ratio of these. I'm going to get my R value and I'm going to get a Vs over Vp, actually a Vp over Vs. So delta Ts over delta Tp is actually equal to R times Vp over Vs. And we all know that Vp over Vs is root 3, right? Because I just told you. All right, so root 3 is about 1.7. So 1.7 squared is 3. Okay, so that's where this number comes from. So for thermal effects, I expect my shear wave travel time residuals to be 3 times the size of my P wave travel time residuals. Okay, now a travel time residual here is the measured travel time minus the time that you would compute for a spherical Earth, right? So a travel time residual is zero if the Earth is spherically symmetric, right? So that's what we're looking at here. Okay. All right. Now this this picture shows I work at long periods, and I guess it's worthwhile explaining. So seismology used to be divided into two worlds. There was the short period world and there was the long period world. And the reason for that, there was this thing called the microseism band in the middle, between 7 and 14 seconds, and it's very noisy, right? It's generated by oceanic waves, and it propagates through the whole of the interior of continents. And historically, seismic recording systems were not able to resolve seismic signals on top of the microseism. So they were filtered to either look at periods shorter than about 5 seconds or periods longer than about 15 seconds. Right? So that's where the great divide into short period and long period seismology started. Of course, these days we can record 24 bits and we can record everything and filter afterwards, right? And you know, that's good because you know this kind of time scale you're looking at, 10 or 15 seconds, is the characteristic time scale on which earthquakes happen. So it's a very interesting time scale to look at, so we need it. All right, so long period waves are good. These are waves of about 20 second period, right? So they have wavelengths on the order of 200 kilometers, right? So they don't care about the difference between here and San Diego, right? If you work with a 1 second P wave, then you're talking about 10 kilometers, right? And that does care about the difference between here and San Diego. So that can be an issue. So let me just show you what a few of these things are. So this is time as a function of epicentral distance, and this is a stack of real data, right? So this is what's actually in the seismograms, okay? This is the first arriving P wave, and it goes to about 98 degrees. Oops, actually it continues on. And the reason it continues on is that 98 degrees is where you hit the core mantle boundary. Right. Remember, as I go along here, I'm turning deeper and deeper inside the Earth. Right. And here is where I hit the core mantle boundary. And here I'm diffracting around the core mantle boundary. Right. So you're looking at P diffracted all the way around to about 130 degrees. Okay. This is S. And this is a vertical component instrument, which is a little bit of a pain for S because this guy here is SKS. And it cuts over S at about 80 degrees. And so this means that any S waves that you measure from verticals are contaminated beyond distances of about 80 degrees. So you can't actually image the bottom of the mantle, right, because of this kind of contamination here. These are core phases. This here, all right, so I've lost my, this is PCS. All right, so this is double S, triple S, quadruple S. This is the Rayleigh way. All right, and you can see there are lots of other things going on in here. These, yeah. So there's lots of choices you can make to move from. You can remember this, right? Because when we do S waves, we like to look at transverse components because, you know, P waves are not supposed to be polarized in the transverse direction, so they should all disappear. This P wave is a little rude and managed to stay on the transverse component. So that's not supposed to be there. So this is S, right? You can maybe see a little bit of SKS still. That shouldn't be there. This is SCS. This goes all the way back here, but it's very prominent here. I'm going to be looking at SCS minus S differential times. This is SS. I'll show you what the ray paths look like in a second. We're going to be looking at these differential times too between SS and S. Now, why is this P wave here? Well, it could be an interesting thing or it could be a boring thing, right? The interesting thing would be if we had anisotropy in the Earth, right? And it was rotating the wave field from the transverse onto the P wave onto the transverse component. That might be happening. What's more likely happening is that when we make a transverse component, we have to rotate the horizontal components. Right? The horizontal components are north, south, and east, west. And so we just do a numerical transformation into radial and transverse. You know? So radial is away from the earthquake, transverse is perpendicular to that. So that means I have to know the calibrations, or at least the relative calibrations, my seismometers accurately to be able to do that. And so probably this is just, well, and I also have to know the orientation of the seismometers, which turns out is harder than you would think, apparently. So in the old days, before we had, gyroscopic compasses and all the rest of it, oftentimes people would screw up with the magnetic correction, they would use a compass. Right, and there would be a 14 degree declination anomaly, and the instrument would be now oriented at 28 degrees, right? So it happened. Okay, so all of that stuff happened.
Quick question.
Yeah.
At 150 or 140 and 20, right, what is that?
Like
150-ish and going, yeah, there.
Yeah. That's a little residual of the core phases, I think. Who knows? It's probably. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get rid of anything which is really bright on the vertical. Whoops, going the wrong way again. So, yeah, that's probably something to do with.
Okay.
It's just.
Then it's an acoustic distance, you've got a lot of waves coming in together. That's why they're.
Yeah, so if anything that's really bright, right, is probably, if there's any error in the rotation, it's going to get put on there. All right, so what I used to do was I used to torture my grad students and make them pick these things by hand, right? And we would make a little impulse response to the instrument and fit it to the P wave and to the S wave. And actually, you can do this to about a tenth of a second, right? Visually, you can, you know, it's amazing, right? So you can do this subsampled. You know, these things are sampled at one sample per second, but you can actually make these arrival time measurements very precisely. One day, I realized I had just made the same measurement 50 times, right? I thought, this is stupid. So I actually made this is a record section of P waves for a single event. This is going, this is between 20 and 100 degrees. And you can see these long period waves, they look pretty similar, right? And it turns out that the waveform is really not that much of a function of the earthquake source. It's more just a function, well, it's not a function of the receiver, it's more a function of the earthquake source. At short periods, waveforms are distorted by local structure around the receiver. Right? At long periods, that isn't true because the wavelengths are too long, and you end up with very similar waveforms. And so this is a natural for doing cross-correlation, right? You look at that, say, I'm going to cross-correlate everything to everything else. So I choose a little time window here, and I cross-correlate everything to everything else. I then have a cross-correlation coefficient which tells me how similar things are to each other, right? So I can cluster them by their degree of similarity. And this is what you get. So now you can see that there's a group here that's all very, very similar. There's a group here that's a little bit. And this is called a cluster diagram here. So what you do is you take a vertical cursor and you move in this direction, and then you cut, you would click about here, and it would divide this into clusters depending upon how they're grouped here, right? So with a single click, you can divide this into a bunch of waveforms which are very similar to each other, and then actually what we do is stack them up and fit to a synthetic. So you end up doing manually fitting maybe 2 or 3 seismograms per event instead of 200. So it takes a few seconds to do an earthquake, right? So we have hundreds of thousands of these arrivals. Okay, I just thought I would show you. This is a nice example of a transverse component here with S and double S. And this is an example of the Earth doing Hilbert transforms. The Earth is very good at doing Hilbert transforms. And let me show you what's going on here. So SS is interesting because it has a... in a second. So SS is an S wave that bounces off the underside of the Earth and does this, right? So there's an S leg and an S leg. Yeah. SSS is another one, right? So this would be SSS, right? Now, if you draw a ray tube, right? So supposing I draw something that looks like this, and then come down here, then oops, right? And then I come down here. Oops. Every time my ray tube folds, I get a 90-degree phase shift. That's a Hilbert transform. So this is actually a Hilbert transform. This is 2 Hilbert transforms, triple S. So that's 180 degrees. And that's just a sine flip, right? So this should be a sine flip of this. Right? Pretty good job, I thought, right? Okay. But that tells you something. It means that you have to correct for the Hilbert transform when you make a relative arrival. A differential travel time measurement between, this is brutal. All right, between here and here. And you also have to correct for, so I'm making differential times between S and double S. And you have, so there's the Hilbert transform effect you have to correct for, and you have to correct for the fact that there are 2 extra legs in the upper mantle. And the upper mantle is highly attenuating. The asthenosphere has a Q on the order of 80, which is highly attenuating. And that means that double S is broadened relative to S because S only has 2 legs through there. All right, so these are the kinds of things that we measure. This we still do by hand, but we could probably figure out some way of being clever about it. Okay, so here is a plot of SS versus S, 75 degrees. Here's the source. Here's the receiver. And I'm also going to show you some SCS minus S differential times. Now, it turns out the middle of the mantle is boring, right? We all know that. So if that's the case, and we'll just assume that it is, then that means that for SS minus S, then this is going to be important. And for SCS minus S, this is going to be important. And we hope and pray that structure near the source and receiver for the differential times kind of cancels out, right? Because it's very similar for the two rays, right? So if I measure a differential time, then it should dominantly be sensitive to this point here for SS minus S and this point here for SCS minus S. So what I do is I take all my measurements and I bin them where the bounce point is, right? And so these are residual times binned at the bounce point on the core mantle boundary for SCS minus S. You can see the range here is minus 20 seconds to 20 seconds. These are not small signals, right? These are really big signals. And what you should see is the ring around the Pacific, and this is the Pacific LSVP, and less well sampled is the African LSVP. But there it is, right, in the data, right? You don't need a black box to see this. It's right there. Now, if God had been kind, yep.
Where there is no dot, does that mean that there is no measurement, or that the measurement is
there's no bounce
at
points
zero?
There. There's no bounce points there. And the reason for that is that the distances where I have both SES and S is limited. I can only really do it from about 45 to about 75 degrees. So I have to have source and receiver geometries, you know, in that distance range, and that means that some of the southern hemisphere, you know, unless somebody starts putting out those lovely OBSs,
yeah. Right? So I guess why I'm asking that mostly is to ask whether there is any place where you have a zero, kind of like no deviation, where it's normal in this.
Well, there are lots of places where this is small, right? So, but yeah, the white is nothing, and that's because of the distance range in which I'm working.
So plus or minus 10 seconds is zero, essentially, normal.
Well, I don't know what threshold I should choose an LLSVP to be at, right? But I could do something at some point. All right, now, ideally what I would have would be PCP minus P, right? That would be perfect. And the reason that we don't is that God was not kind to us, right? How much something is reflected depends upon the impedance contrast, and that is the density times the velocity. And it turns out that God made the density times the velocity on both sides of the core metal boundary be almost exactly the same, right? So long period PCPs are very, very rare and low amplitude. So I cannot make this map for PCP minus P, which is a huge shame, because then you would be able to look straight away and see if you had thermal anomalies or not, right? But we can't do that. Now we can do it for SS minus S and PP minus P for the near surface stuff. Right, so here's SS minus S, and you know, it should look like tectonics, right? And you can see oceans and continents, cratons, all the rest of it. So this is Australia here, which is an Australian-centric plot. And you know, I'm limited here again because I have to have both SS and S on the seismogram, but SS goes all the way out to 180 degrees. So if I'm brave, I can just look at SS on its own. Right, and then I can get almost complete coverage of the Earth, right? But this is not a differential time, right? So this also has sensitivity to structure at the source and receiver. But I'm just binning them at the bounce points in the middle here, and you can see it's pretty similar, right? Just fills in the holes. A little bit different. What? My wife accuses me of being selectively deaf, so.
Yeah. I was about to ask you where you were plotting them, but then you said bounce points.
Yeah, it's all done at the bounce point. So this is PP minus P, and you can, if you, it does look a lot like the SS minus S. We'll do that in a minute. And then this is the absolute PP minus P. So you can see that we are getting pretty good global coverage in these things, right? So we're not fooling around. Now what I can do is I can look at a point on here, actually on this one, and I can look at the same point in the SS minus S, and I can plot one versus the other, right? And if this is thermal in origin, then they should make a 3-to-1 slope, right? So, all right, so this is a 3-to-1 slope through here. So this is just each, you know, just taking caps, common caps, and plotting them one against the other. So I know there's a lot of scattering here, right? But to zeroth order, it's a 3-to-1 slope. And that tells you the upper mantle structure is probably thermally dominated. And that should not be a surprise, right? 71% of the surface is ocean, right? So most of what goes on in the upper mantle is thermal in origin. The continents are a bit of a nuisance, but. Right? So this is not a surprise. And this means that when you start looking at the models, you should have an R value on the order of 1.7 in the upper mantle, right? If it's significantly different from that, then you probably have an issue. All right, now. All right, so now I'm gonna look at the P and the S, and I changed my operating system, and now none of my code for plotting this stuff works anymore. I'm gonna use some older plots, you're just gonna have to believe me. So what I'm gonna do is to, I'm going to take data at different distance ranges or different turning point ranges, and then bin the data at the turning point of the ray and look at this as a function of depth, make a histogram of these residuals as a function of depth. Okay, actually, these are just raw residuals and in different turning points. So this is for P going deeper and deeper and deeper into the mantle. And you can see the histogram of P residuals essentially looks identical, doesn't change. The S, on the other hand, gets this really ugly lump on the positive residual side, right? And that tells you that there are a lot of really slow S arrivals, right? But there aren't any correspondingly really slow P arrivals.
Guy, quick question.
What's this residual with respect to?
Sorry?
What is this residual with respect to?
These are all with respect to a spherical Earth model, so these would all be zero. Probably not. It's probably, I'm trying to remember. We actually generate new averages, right? Because Prem is not the, you know, it's not a perfect Earth model. So we're actually solving for a one-dimensional model at the same time, and these are with respect to an improved one-dimensional model.
A quick question. So these, the data that get binned here, are they kind of the average for every little bin
no,
on the surface, or are they just raw data?
When I make the pictures, I bin them, but these are just raw data.
Okay.
All right.
So they're like the relative size of the lump does not necessarily correspond to its size in the real world.
No, there's some sampling issues there, right? If everything were uniformly sampled, this would be a more robust measure, but it's just pointing out, you know, the sampling of P and S is not that different. And the P does not have this lump, right? But the S does. Okay. So the only point I'm trying to make is, you go deep in the mantle, there are a lot more slow S arrivals than there are slow P arrivals. And so if you now, this is when you bin the data, and now I'm making the same plot like I did for SS minus S versus PP minus P. So these are bin residuals, and going down in the mantle, and then you try and fit a slope to this, and that's the slope, and then you can get an R value from this little calculation that I did here. Right. So what you see is that as you go down in the mantle, the R value starts to increase because the slope is getting much, much higher. And the reason that it's getting much, much higher is because all of these really very slow S arrivals, right? So you get very slow S arrivals, but you don't have the corresponding slow P arrivals. So this tells you that there is something weird going on in the Earth, and in fact, we exceeded R equals 2.5 at about 2,200 kilometers, right? So if you take this at face value, this says that you're getting an anti-correlation between bulk sound speed and shear velocity starting quite high up in the mantle. Now, these are just the whole mantle, and we know that the weird regions are limited, right? It's not the whole mantle, so we'll come to that in a minute. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just going to sort of ask a question about that. It looks like there's a slope break, in fact, in that you have many more high DTS residuals.
Right.
And low ones, right? And that you actually in that final plot, there's a sort of slope break between some that have extremely delayed S wave arrivals.
Right. And so these are ones which are sampling the bottom 300 kilometers of the mantle, and these are all sampling within the LRSVPs. Yeah. So they're way off. All right. So I'm going to take a brief digression here, just to show you the kind of seismic tomography that I do. All right. So this is. This is a plot of the lower mantle model, and these are slices through the Earth of S-wave anomaly, and this is in percent, so 2.2, this is plus or minus 2.2%, and this is typically what you see in these models, and these are actually quite well resolved. So you can see slabs in the uppermost lower mantle, easily down to 1,000 kilometers, here's Tonga, right, so even maybe a little deeper, and then they kind of fade out. And then, of course, at the bottom, you have these large, low shear velocity provinces. But as we get better and better at doing this, they become less and less monolithic, right? And we get more and more structure in them, right? So even the African anomaly is beginning to. We have probably better data coverage now, and you can. So this is the bottom of the mantle, and the next highest layer. And so you can take some point in here and trace it up, right? And it's going a long way up, right? So this is 16, this is 1,000 kilometers above the core mountain boundary. So this guy, not so much, right? But the African one certainly seems to go way up there, all right? But the point I want to get across is that the LSVPs are not quite as monolithic as they were in the older models. And you know, this is French and Romanovich, and you can see it's also very blobby, which is a function of the waveform modeling. Models tend to be like this. But I think that, you know, and if I didn't have a chance to plot these two on the same page, but they are actually quite similar in their blobbiness. Right, so this is an old plot, but just to show, this is the Pacific LSVP, and you can see that it's not monolithic. There's lots of little things sticking up out of it, and they're quite coherent for quite a ways. And then the last point that I want to make is that if you make a flat Earth approximation and look at the lower mantle here, this is where the upper mantle removed, then here's the Pacific LSVP and the African LSVP. And then here are all these slabs that are, you can see in the top of the lower mantle. You know, these are down to 1,500 kilometers or so. And then there's this ring of blue around the bottom, and then there's this fading out of structure in the middle, right? So it's very hard, unless you're really clever with the color scale, to make slabs look like they go all the way through
the mantle. And to clarify, the reason it fades out is not because we lose sensitivity to that depth range, but because the actual velocity anomalies are different.
In fact, the resolution of structure in the mid-mantle is probably the best of anywhere. Right. Okay, so now let's get back to the correlation of bolt sound speed to VS. So, all right, so what I showed you, patterns suggest a normal thermal origin for upper mantle structure and a non-thermal origin for at least part of the lower mantle. Now I'm going to show you an embarrassingly old slide. This is so I did this study in 2000, and then it took, for some reason, 16 years for somebody else to do this again. I don't quite know why. But this is an inversion of travel time data and actually free oscillation data. I'll come back to that in a minute. And it's actually an inversion for VS and VC, and then VP is recovered from these two. If you try and get VC from looking at a VS and VP model, and you just difference them with that formula I had on the first page, then you'll get garbage, right? You'll get total garbage. You can't subtract a P model from an S model and get anything that looks like a real bolt sound speed model. All right, so you actually have to do these joint inversions. And the point here is that the bulk sound speed here at the base of the mantle really does look anti-correlated to the shear velocity. And you can see the shear velocity looks a lot like the P velocity, right? So you can look at these pictures and you can make little histograms of the R values and look at different depths, and sure enough, you find deep now that the average R value is about 2.5. So it's not quite, well, it's about at the point where things go anti-correlated, but on average, it's still almost okay. And then you can look at the correlation between shear and compression as a function of depth, and that's very high. And that's because P models are really dominated by the shear effects that P waves sense, right? So P and S models are always going to look very similar to one another. And then we go anti-correlated here down in the bottom few hundred kilometers of the mantle. And the R value just takes off right at the bottom. So this study suggested that we were getting the anti-correlation, and specifically in the LSVPs, in the bottom few hundred, 500 or so kilometers of the mantle. Now, I think you already looked at this was Mulik and Ekstrom featured in one of the tutorials? I thought I heard it was. So here now they're looking at shear velocity, compression velocity. So this is a very similar kind of study, but with more and different kinds of data. And then this is their value of R going down inside the Earth. You can see that they get up to about 2.45 on average, so very similar to what we got. And then if you look at, these are just the amplitudes, and there's on the green on here is a Su and Zivansky model. So this was my effort here, which went negative right at the base of the mantle. This is their effort, which goes anti-correlated a little higher. And then this Su and Zivansky, this older model here, as you can see, is negative throughout almost the whole Earth. All right, and that should just set off alarm bells, right? It's just, It's just so hard to find an explanation for this being negative anywhere, but to have it be negative through the whole Earth is crazy. And I can tell you why I think it's crazy. All right, I can't prove this. But it's to do with those pesky mislocations of earthquakes. Right? So the signal from 3D structure for shear waves is big. Right? And the fact that you don't know exactly where the earthquakes are is not such a big deal. For P waves, this isn't true. Right? The signal from a typical mislocation of an earthquake is almost exactly the same size as the signal from 3D structure. Right? So when you do an inversion for P velocity 3D structure, you have to include the earthquake locations. It's just the way it is. Now, Barbara claims that's not true, and the reason for that is she's using 40-second body waves. Right? So, you know, 40-second body waves don't care so much if you're off a second. Right? A 20-second body wave does care, and you can get the wrong answer. There are lots of ways you can do this, and probably the simplest-minded way of doing this is to say, okay, I'll take my 1D model, I'll relocate the earthquakes. All right, now, then I'm going to solve for 3D structure, and then I'll relocate earthquakes again. Right? But that's just a really bad thing to do. And the reason it's bad is that that works if 3D structure is like a random noise signal. Right? But, you know, 3D structure is not random. It's large scale, many places. So there are whole groups of residuals which are very slow because they went through an LLSVP. And if you relocate the earthquake, you'll just suck that up into the origin time of the earthquake, right? You just lose it. So you have to do the earthquake locations at the same time as the as you do the modeling.
I have a question. Now that we're on this plot, and you showed this a couple of slides back, you're focusing on the lowermost mantle where there's really an anti-correlation and the R values are like 2.5 or higher. But what about the mid-mantle where the correlation is also not so good? And it looks like it's not purely thermal effect.
Oh, okay.
Like say between 1,000 and 2,000 or...
Oh.
We're close to zero here. And it's also true in other models like Paula Kuhlemeier's model.
Yeah, so this is the global correlation, right? If you were to do the correlation in different geographic parts of the model, then you would see different depth extents for the correlations, right? So there would be a strong and negative correlation. If you just did it inside the LSVPs, right, then you would see a strong and negative correlation to higher depth, right? And if you did it outside the LSVPs, you would see a more positive correlation. Right? So this is just an average of everything.
Yeah, I understand that. But the question is more like, can you explain the mid-mantle, say between 1,000 and 2,000, just by thermal effects alone?
Maybe. Yeah. I'm sure there are places where it would be difficult to do that, but probably on average that would be possible. I'm guessing, right? I'm just trying to distinguish between large regions here, right? The base of the mantle and the uppermost mantle.
Guy, I have a question. So when you were saying that iterative source relocation and source inversion was a bad idea, it sounded at the beginning that you were saying more for VP.
Yeah.
At least Barbara's group, the model that you're showing does not contain P waves.
Right. And so that's when Ebru gave a talk and I saw VP VS ratios in there, and then I got excited, right? Because then I get worried about how the earthquakes are being affected. So this is not such a, you know, it's kind of easy to make a good S model because you don't have to worry about a lot of these details. But as you know, the P models are not anywhere near as.
If there is a systematic bias in the origin times, then it should also affect S waves, right? Actually, it should affect this source uncertainty is going to be in all kinds of waves.
Yeah.
You are working with.
Yeah.
Of course, if you start P-wave perturbations are smaller. That's why we think that they are likely more affected by source
right.
uncertainties.
Right.
However, we are also mapping all these source uncertainties into shear wave speeds as well.
Right. So you should be using all your data to relocate the earthquakes. Right?
Exactly.
P and everything.
that would be
get the best
case.
Location yeah. that you can. And actually, it turns out that if you make the 3D model first and then relocate the earthquakes, then you don't get into as much trouble. So you can actually do iterative inversion as long as you don't relocate the earthquakes first. Anyway, so this is another VSVP model that came out recently. This is Paula Kolomaya and company. So this uses radio waves, travel times, and spheroidal modes. Now I know what that stands for. And so these are VS models and VP models at four different depths. And so, of course, they also have density associated with this. Right. So this is a long wavelength model. So this is kind of like the model that I made in 2000. And it's that way because Paula's mainly interested in what effect the free oscillations have on things, particularly on VP VS ratios and density VS ratios. So she's mainly interested in the long wavelengths. So this looks fine. If you do the thing of plotting bins of VP versus VS and making this R value, then you find that it's pretty high. These are all close to the core mantle boundary, right? So, and then these actually go down. So right at the base of the mantle, she has the R value decreasing. Now, this model worries me. And you know, I think Paula is great, and I usually trust what she does. But this model has extremely low P wave amplitudes throughout most of the model. That means relative to S, so the R value is actually pretty high, right? So, and you have anti-correlation of bulk sound speed to shear velocity throughout most of the mantle, right? So I think this is indicative of something being not quite right with this inversion, right? These P amplitudes are just too small.
Yeah, I think there's a, in their inversion choice, they fix the scaling. And now I can't remember exactly what, but they fix the scaling between two parameters ahead of time and then invert for it later after kind of including that fixed scaling. So essentially, they kind of bias their results by assuming a scaling and not getting...
Yeah, I'm not sure how it arose, but I don't think that the size of these P-wave anomalies is realistic, right? And it gives you this funny behavior of the bulk sound speed pretty much throughout the whole mantle, right? So I'm sure the shear velocity model is just fine, right? And you can see, again, the correlation between VS and VP is very high. That's always true, okay? All right, so these are my conclusions for the first part of this talk. So bulk sound speed, shear velocity are negatively correlated, at least in the lowermost mantle, and the anti-correlation extends well above D double prime. This worries me, and I hope I've gotten the message across that bulk sound speed should be small, right? And oftentimes in these models, it's as big as the P velocity variations, and that's very hard to do physically, right? So, and you know, bulk sound speed, because it's small, it's more affected by earthquake locations, it's more affected by everything that you do, right? So it's just a tricky thing to get. But I think we do have this robust negative correlation in the LLSVPs at the base of the mantle. And I don't think that's going to go away. And I don't understand what it is. So it implies presence of chemical phase heterogeneity. I don't know whether the mineral physicist can tell me exactly what that is. I ask Lars every year, and he says he doesn't know. So I don't think that post-perovskite is a good explanation for this. Post-perovskite is supposed to exist in the cold parts of the lower mantle, and we tend to think that those are the blue regions around the LLSVPs, and they're pretty damn normal, right? It's the red stuff in the LLSVPs, which is hot, which is abnormal, this abnormal behavior extends well above the core mantle boundary. So I don't know whether post-perovskite is really capable of doing this. Yep?
Just a quick question, because there have been a couple of papers about some candidate materials that can give this anticorrelation, which is basically a iron-enriched bridgmanite. Like, so a material that is enriched in bridgmanite by 20%, so basically that means it's almost a pure bridgmanite, and then there's quite okay. iron-enriched at the same time, 3% or
so. So you're talking about extremely iron-rich.
Yeah, it could be a magma ocean cumulate or something. It's. Yeah. I think there are three papers that come to this conclusion.
Okay.
Like the first one is the Deschamps et al. 2012 in EPSL.
All right. I mean, maybe I'll let Lars respond.
Yeah, so Jeannot Trompert showed in 2004, I think, that if you have lateral variations in silica content and FeO content in, at the base of the mantle, then you can produce anticorrelation just by looking at combinations of bridgenite and ferropericlase. And so that's one possible explanation. You could ask how satisfying that explanation is, because it's not connected to any plausible genetic process. And I guess that's partly what Maxime is getting at. It would be nice to have some genetic process that produces the chemical heterogeneity that explains the anticorrelation.
Okay, this sounds like a great topic for a slider thing to me. Sana?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to follow on the comment that the fast regions in the D double prime are normal, but it's a bit odd that they have such fast gradients right next to the hot core mantle boundary. And I think in that sense, they're still odd, like all topographic models have like a fast...
Yeah, no, I would
a change in gradient there right next to the hot.
Yeah, I think all D double prime is pretty weird, but just like the inner core. All right, so what I was supposed to talk about is density, right? All right, so, okay, so I love free oscillations as much as Jessica does. So. All right, so this Bolivia happened in 1994 in June. My cat died that day, actually, and I ascribed this to my cat going down to hell, and leaving me a message on the way. So the great thing about Bolivia, so this, you know, it was an 8.3 at 630 kilometers, and you know that's wonderful. Didn't kill anybody because it's so deep. This is 10 days of data, right? And the best thing about this was nothing happened for 10 days. There was no big earthquake anywhere else in the world. There were no massive aftershocks. In fact, there were almost no aftershocks at all. So this is perfect, right? This doesn't happen very often. Right, so you Fourier transform this thing, and as Jessica said, you get lots of nice peaks, and they come readily labeled like this. No, they don't. You have to have a model to decide what these are, but you know, you should know what 2S0, 3S0, 4S0, and 5S0 are. These are all overtones of breathing modes of the Earth, right? That you should have got from yesterday. So this is just a little cartoon showing the American football mode, okay, the breathing mode here, and then these toroidal modes are twisting on concentric shells. And these guys have shapes which are related to spherical harmonics, and now you all know what spherical harmonics look. This is a degree 0, degree 1, degree 2, degree 3. And you know, degree 2, you can see this elliptical ball shape, so this actually is a good model in gravity for modeling the shape of the Earth's elliptical bulge. This is a good model in geomagnetism for modeling the dipole field, right? And then we have all these other shapes. So these shapes of spherical harmonics, of modes of oscillation of the Earth, you know, spheroidal modes on vertical components have these kinds of geographic shapes. All right, so these are the modes which have been, spheroidal modes which have been observed, and this is frequency versus harmonic degree, so we're getting wigglier as we go in this direction. And actually we're getting wiggler in radius as we go in this direction. And there are some normal modes. This is the fundamental mode. If I add up these, I make Rayleigh waves. So one way to think about free oscillations is that, you know, I give the Earth a kick, and every free oscillation is excited some way, and then it just starts to decay away. You know, if I could kick the Earth in a special way, maybe I could just excite one of these, and I could just watch it decay away. So what the seismogram is a sum of decaying cosinusoids, right? That's all it is, right? So, you know, modes are really, really simple to think about. I just make up sums of decaying cosinusoids, and the interference between those will give me surface waves, body waves, everything else. It gives me diffracted waves, right? You know, these guys are easy. You know, it's the easiest way to make a synthetic seismogram. Now, these guys here will play a prominent role in what we talk about. And these are Stoneley modes. So these have their energies trapped close on the core mantle boundary. And Paola has been measuring a few of these in the vicinity of some of these crossovers. Now, so this is the zeroth branch, this is the first branch, this is the second branch, and you can see you get these little kissings of these branches. And depending on the Earth model, you can get modes here which are almost hybrid between a normal mantle mode and a Stoneley mode, right? And that's very model dependent. Right? So once you get in this group here, you're really a Stoneley mode. And it's very hard to excite them, and it's very hard to see them because you're at the top, right? This guy is the fundamental mode for the inner core, and then these are all the overtones for the inner core. So all of the inner core modes are there. We can't see them, right, because they're not excited by earthquake sources at the surface. And the only way we could see these guys is if they coupled into another mode, which we did see at the surface. Then you'll see some of these pseudo branches go flat, right? So if you take the derivative of frequency with respect to harmonic degree, d omega by dl, that's just proportional to group velocity, d omega by dk, right? Ka equals l plus a half. So anything that's on these branches has very low group velocities, right? And these correspond to modes which go up and down in the mantle, but don't go sideways very fast. And when you add those up, you make SES, multiple SES, or multiple PCP, or multiple PCS, all those things, right? But we're mainly interested in these guys. A lot of these things have been measured. All right, so Jessica showed you some of the energy sensitivities. So these modes have all been observed. This is typical fundamental mode. This is shear sensitivity. So this is normalized radius. So this is the inner core boundary here, and this is the core mantle boundary here. Right, so this is the mantle, outer core, inner core. And then we have all these lovely overtones, 11S4. These are all PK, IKP equivalent type modes. And these are wonderful for doing stuff in the inner core. And you can see they have very different shapes in radius, which means that they're really good for isolating information about structure inside the Earth. And the for spherical Earth, this is the reason why modes are so important for doing spherical Earth, because they have such different samplings that you can really use them to make delta functions, right, to really sample closely inside the Earth. All right, so this is a long period, these are long period seismograms from the Bolivian earthquake. You can see surface waves, and the reason that you can is because I low pass filtered this down to about 150 seconds. So at 150 seconds, 630 kilometers still excites surface waves, right? And there actually, there is a synthetic and the data on here, the data, there's a dashed line, and there are a few places you can see the dashed line, right? But this is, you know, this is all made by summing up decaying cosinusons, right? Moles, they interfere, you get all of this stuff, and it's pretty darn good fit to the data. If you give me any earthquake which is deeper than 400 kilometers, I guarantee you I can fit them almost perfectly in this frequency band. Not true for shallow earthquakes, right? And the reason is shallow earthquakes, big ones, are often strongly distributed, right? The 2004 Andaman Island earthquakes ruptured for 400 seconds, right? So that's, 1,200 kilometers, right? That's not a point source. These guys, the deep earthquakes, Bolivia, it went on for a long time, it just went around in circles, right? Because it could never get out of the slab, right? So I'm a firm believer in transformational faulting. Just because I know that all deep earthquakes are very confined in space, so it has to have something to do with that. All right. Okay, so 0S2, this is going to be important in the discussion of density, and I always ignored it because it just looked perfectly normal to me, right? So it's not an anomaly split or anything, so I just ignored it. So Jessica showed you some of this yesterday. On this station, you can see three lines of 0S2, and it's rotation of the Earth that's dominantly splitting this thing. And if it were only rotation, it would just make a little picket fence. There would just be five lines, right? And this you see three of them. Now, I know what the geographic shape of each of these lines is. We call these singlets, and the five singlets in here make a multiplet, which is the multiplet 0s2. And I know, because for this particular mode, it's rotation that's causing dominantly what's going on, I know the geographic shape of each one, so I can stack the records to isolate individual singlets, right? Once I know the geographic shape and I have lots of stations around the world, I can take combinations of records to isolate each individual singlet. That should be intuitively true. I mean, it's something we do in low-frequency seismology all the time. And it allows you to separate out modes which have different shapes, right? So you're using combinations of data from all around the world to separate out different shaped modes. So these are what the singlets of 0s2 look like, right? Nice and clean. You can measure their frequencies and attenuation rates very accurately. And this is what the frequencies look like. And this dashed line here is the prediction of a rotating Earth in hydrostatic equilibrium, right? So there is nothing anomalous about this mode. It's doing exactly what we think it should do.
I think in the when you have like a multiplet, all the mode in the one multiplet should have the same frequency or not?
No. So these, if the Earth were not rotating, and it was spherically symmetric, all of these would have exactly the same frequency. Right. It's the fact that. All right. So you can think of the wave field generated by 0s2 as being the wave field for a non-rotating Earth. But when the Earth is starting to rotate, that wave field processes around, right? It will slowly process around. And the frequency domain manifestation of that is this splitting, right?
If you go to the previous slide, you can see like there's a frequency. No, not that one.
This one?
Yeah. There's a frequency shift.
The frequency shift, these are just the five lines. So I've stacked records to isolate individual singlets, right? So the raw data look like this, where you have more than one line per record. Yeah. And then I'm just taking combinations of data to try and isolate individual lines. I can do that because I know the shapes, right? So and then that's the outcome of that process. So I've now isolated the individual singlets from all of the data I have for this particular earthquake. And now I can measure the frequencies and the attenuation rates that should relate to the width of these things. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Okay. All right, so 0s2 will figure. How are we doing here? What about Stoney modes? All right, so these are these guys. So Paula measured some of the 1s branch. She measured 2s16, which is about here. She measured 3s25, I think, 3s26. Which for me is maybe a bridge too far, but we'll see. All right. So, and this is what the energy density. So this is shear, and this is compressional energy. Looks like for a Stoney mode, and this is right in the middle of the Stoney block, right? So this is 2s20. So 2s20 is that one right there. So it's well away from this osculation, which comes from the Latin to kiss. I'm sure you knew that. All right, so this is a true Stoney mode, and it's very difficult to either excite. You're up here with your earthquake, right? And you're trying to excite this thing, and you're trying to record it. And you're sitting on this tail of this mode that has its maximum energy deep inside the Earth. So it's tough, right? Okay. All right, now, if you look at these things, so this is a spectrum from Sea of Okhotsk earthquake in 2013, and 1s12 is a Stoney mode, right? And it's right next to 0s17. And so this is one of the modes that Paula analyzed. Now, you have to be careful looking at this and saying, this is 1s12. And the reason for that is that in this frequency band, there's a huge amount of mode coupling going on, and it's caused by the Coriolis force of the Earth. Right, so it's not a structural effect, right? We understand it very well, and it couples 0SL modes to 0TL+1 or 0TL-1 modes. So it couples fundamental spheroidal to fundamental toroidal modes, and it's really strong. So those fundamental toroidal modes start appearing on vertical components because they're no longer really toroidal modes. They're a mixture of spheroidal and toroidal energy. And Jessica showed you some of the frequencies associated with that, but you can just look at a seismogram, right? And you see these double modes here. And this is a toroidal mode. These are all toroidal modes. Well, they're not really. They're coupled spheroidal toroidal modes. And this is a vertical component instrument, right? So you have to be careful. And, you know, I didn't know about this, and I identified some core modes, 6S2 and 7S3, because there wasn't any spheroidal mode near there, and I was wrong. It was a toroidal mode. And there was another thing going on that I didn't know about, and that was they were being continuously excited, so they looked like they were high Q modes, but they weren't, right? So they were humming away. So I, my first mode paper, 1981, it's almost all wrong. Right? So how about that? All right, so this guy could be 1S12, but it probably isn't. It's probably 0T18. Okay, but 1S12 is under there somewhere, right? And you can use the fact that the modes have different shapes, right, to try and tease these things apart. All right, and that's what Paola did. And all I need to, this is all the math that you need. All right, so we're going to expand our Earth model in spherical harmonics. And these are the coefficients that we need to know as a function of radius. And I've written this as a vector because there are perturbations in density, Vp, and Vs, right? So there really are three things going on here. And then what I can measure, and I recommend reading the first 156 pages of my notes. If you do that, you will understand how we can determine structure coefficients from mode data. They are related to these things, which is what we want to know by these kernels. And these kernels are pretty much those energy densities that I've been showing you, right? We can compute them, and they're different for every mode, right? So the CSTs, we can plug them in this little formula here to make a map, right? And what that map gives you is an integrated depth average of structure as seen by this particular mode and filtered by this kernel here. Right, and we call these things splitting functions. So they're an easy way to see what the mode is seeing inside the Earth. You just have to remember what its kernel looks like so you can figure out how it's integrating the structure as a function of depth. And you also have to remember that these things are really just, by and large, they're just even order structure because that's all that modes do. You know, standing waves do a really good job of averaging out order structure. They do a perfect job, actually. Okay, so this is a diversion for mode people. So Arwen's catalog, Arwen Deuss has a catalog of mode splitting functions. And this is made by iteratively fitting spectra. And so you adjust the CSTs in a linearized fashion until you fit the spectra, right? It's kind of the obvious thing to do. Now, I have a different way of doing it, which I like better. And what I do is I take combinations of the data that's not important. What is important is that you can have this humongous earthquake, or you can have 10 magnitude 9 earthquakes in a row. I don't care, right? And then you start looking at the wave field. And as it progresses in time, that progression in time is only sensitive to structure. Right, how the wave field is changing. It doesn't care what you kick the earth, how you kick the earth. Right, so if you actually analyze how that waveform is changing as a function of time, you can learn about structure without knowing about the source. So that's what the order aggressive method is, and that's what we do. And so these guys here are just the same modes done using the order aggressive method. You can see they're very similar. These are mantle sensitive, p-sensitive modes. So the biggest coefficient, particularly for core sensitive modes, is the C20. And this is comparing Arwen's iterative spectral fitting with order aggressive. And you can see sometimes there are we don't agree so well, not so well at all. And then these are for mantle sensitive modes, where the agreement is better. So, you know, there's still stuff to be done about looking at the mode catalog of splitting functions. We're converging. But we're not there yet. Yes, Jessica.
I just want to make a quick comment here. I haven't made any of these measurements, but people who aren't mode people might want to be aware of one thing on this plot, which is that the error bars are something that should be taken with caution. Error bars from different studies probably shouldn't be compared if they haven't been computed in different ways, and that these error bars are only partial error bars. So the error bars often are things like, if I remove 3 earthquakes from my data set, how much does this coefficient change?
Right.
So they're not necessarily capturing the full error, so...
Yeah, so the autoregressive method is linear, right? So, and actually what we do now is we just do Monte Carlo Markov chain stuff, right? And then you get a good estimate. So you make thousands of models and get an estimate of the error that way. So that's the way that we're doing it now.
But the error bar, but the points don't overlap to within error. I guess that's just his point, right?
Yeah.
If the error bars were correct, then they would.
Yes. If we had both done a great job of the measurements and the errors, everything should look the same. All right, anyway. So that was just for the benefit of the mode people, Jessica and me. Oh, any more mode people here? All right, so back to bulk shear velocity versus density. So these are some of the Stoney modes that Paula has measured, 1S12, 2S16, 2S25. this is gutsy. All right, and then this is using a model S20RTS, which is a Ritzmer model with a Krussel model, which I guess is one of mine. And this uses delog Vs by delog Vp is 2, and it assumes delog rho by delog Vs is 0.3. So no anticorrelation here with density and shear velocity. And so that predicts these splitting functions, which you can compare with Paula's measurements, and that actually looks pretty good. But consequently, they decided to test whether or not density needed to be scaled that way. So d log rho by d log Vs being 0.3 is a standard number, right? It's what a lot of people use. And does that have to be true? So what they did was that they took the velocities from SP12RTS, which I have a little bit of heartburn about because the P velocities I don't think are okay. And then they varied, and then they let this density scaling go. So here's a prediction for a dense LSVP. You can see it does not. And a prediction for a light LSVP. And this is for, these are for different observed. Prediction SP12, prediction for dense, prediction for light. So they're saying here that these Stoney modes prefer a light LLSVP. Okay, but they are assuming that the velocities that they take from the SP12 RTS are correct. I mean, they do some sensitivity tests and so on. So I don't know whether I can say this is wrong out of hand, but it's an indication that there is some contradiction going on in the field.
I have a question. So if we take SP12 RTS as correct, mm-hmm. From the previous plots, I'm trying to like remember them, but you had showed that they have an anti-correlation between bulk sound speed and Vs above this what we would think of the LLSVP. So essentially in the bulk of the lower mantle, right?
In the bulk of the Earth.
Bulk of the Earth. So then I guess you would say that everywhere outside the LLSVPs, maybe you have an anti-correlation between density and Vs? Or how...
So here they have this anti-correlation. Now here's zero, right? There's a little bit of positively correlated stuff right here. And it's because these P amplitudes are so small.
But, I mean, what does this tell us? Like, let's say this is true. What would that tell us about... Like
it would tell
compositional
you
that heterogeneity in the Earth.
That the Earth is made of really weird stuff. I mean, right? If you're asking for anti-correlations between shear velocity and bulk sound speed all the way through the upper mantle too, then you know it's not thermal, right?
Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Caroline. So could you take that SP12 RTS or even their S models and predict the, SS minus S and PP minus P that you did to see if the predicted data look like the real data? Have people done that? It'd be kind of...
mean, yeah, you could take their model and predict PP minus P, but I'm assuming that Jeroen has already put PP minus P in there, right? They should have, yeah. So, yeah, they should. It's kind of hard to believe, but yeah, they should. Okay, all right, well, yeah, I should do that experiment. All right, so, boy, I gave you a lot of mode stuff, didn't I? Was it fun? Did you enjoy it? Okay, all right, so back to 0s2. All right, so when you take out the rotation and the ellipticity terms, this is the splitting function for 0s2. I think this is according to Arlen. I actually haven't done it. And you can see that the scale here is very small compared to these other guys, and that tells you that it's almost zero, right? So what you then the question is, we have these huge degree two anomalies in the lower mantle. Shouldn't 0s2 be split? Right, when you think about it, you know, it should see those. Should see them just fine. And so this is the sensitivity of 0s2 to density as a function of depth in the mantle. And this is the sensitivity to shear velocity in the mantle. So one of the ways that I can get no signal in 0s2 is to anticorrelate the density and the shear velocity. Right, and then these kernels, because they're the same sign, then I will cancel that effect out. So this may be a little, this is my maybe a little extreme interpretation of what's going on. 0s2 is not really split. We have this stuff going on in the lower mantle. Therefore, to counteract the effect of the shear velocity, I need to make the density be anticorrelated with the shear velocity, just so I don't split 0s2. Right, so that would be my interpretation. I asked Raj if that was true, and he said yes. Okay, all right. So this is Mulik and Ekstrom. They are obviously uncomfortable about having a lot of the lower mantle having this anticorrelation, and so they suck it down deep, right? And they have a 1% excess density down deep. And that's enough to improve the fit to 0s2. Okay. Then there's one other piece of information that recently came into play, and that is something called tidal tomography, right? So tidal tomography is where you use GPS measurements of the semidynamal body tide deformation, and you have to correct for everything, right? And you have to correct for ocean loading. God knows what you have to correct for. And then finally, you can get something that you can interpret in terms of mantle structure. And guess what? Its kernels here look exactly like 0s2, so did a lot of work. You got something that samples the Earth. So that was bad of me, wasn't it? Okay, all right. So you can see what's going to happen.
And right? It's completely independent, right?
It's completely independent. It doesn't have any coupling. You know, you can't complain about a lot of things you can complain about in 0s2. So anyway, so. So this is what they get for excess density in the bottom 350 kilometers of the mantle. They have kind of a coarse parameterization of the lower mantle. And they want it to be about 0.5, the density to be about 0.5% higher in the bottom 600 kilometers of the lower mantle. From my reading of the paper, it seems like they could make it be quite a bit thinner and still get away with it. You know, it's possible that, I mean, this could easily be consistent with the 0s2 story, and I don't know off the top of my head whether this could be made consistent with the Stony Moat story, right? But so this is giving you the same kind of 0.5%, maybe 1%. That would have to be bigger if you made it more compact, right? So so this is a kind of a consistent story on having the anticorrelation between shear velocity and bulk sound speed, right? So we have two conflicting things that we have to deal with here, and I'm not sure what the overall answer is. All right, so this is something I'm going to look at, right? You know, making a non-signal really bugs me, I have to say. So I need to go and look at this. Stony modes apparently prefer light LSVPs, and I'm still not convinced that there aren't trade-offs with the velocities that we may have to worry about. And then the tiled homography results are consistent with 0 as 2 and imply a dense space. So that is my summary of what the current state is in this area. And I hope that was of use to you. And this is my last slide.
Okay. Let's start with student questions. Are you a student? Do we have students? Come on, guys. You can do it. Everything is clear?
Tumor seismology.
Tumor seismology, yeah. You didn't make them dance.
Ah, well, there's no way I'm going to be recorded dancing. Forget that.
What do you think is the way forward to improving P models?
To improving these models? For sure, better estimates of the modes. I mean, everything is interconnected, right? The modes are sensitive to VPVS and density, right? So you have to improve everything to get.
I mean, density. P models.
The what?
P models.
P models. Well, maybe the waveform modelers will get there. If you're careful, if you're really careful, you can come out with a P-wave model that looks reasonable. You have to do everything super carefully. You have to do crustal corrections. You have to do earthquake mislocations. There's all kinds of things that you have to do. And the big problem that we have is not so much the lower mantle, which you can, over time you can illuminate very well. And we can get the southern hemisphere as well as the northern hemisphere by using different phases. It's the upper mantle that's an issue for the P waves. For the S waves, we have fundamental mode surface waves. We have overtones. They have some sensitivity to compression velocity, but not that much. And so it turns out that in all of these models, the region which is the worst correlated between them tends to be the transition zone or just above the transition zone. And the reason is that the fundamental modes are flaking out on you as you go deeper, and you don't have the benefit of the turning body waves, right? We tend to use teleseismic body waves, which means distances beyond 20 degrees for P waves. And the reason for that is that there are triplications associated with the 410 and the 660 around 20 degrees. And that means there are multiple arrivals, right? So if I were to draw a travel time curve Jeff used to call this the 20 degree discontinuity here. So you go like this, right? So there's two triplications here associated with the 410 and the 660. So from a P wave arrival time picking point of view, this is a nightmare, right? Because a lot of times these amplitudes back here are caustics and they're larger, right? So it's very complicated. Of course, what you can do is to model these directly, right, and actually do waveform modeling of triplicated phases to look at transition zone and shallower structure. And that's probably a good way to go from the non-full waveform type perspective, right, is to start looking at these things to get a handle on the upper mantle. Otherwise, you're left, a lot of these models are using scalings between VP and VS to get the P model out there. That's dominantly what's controlling it.
You talk about mode coupling. When you're coupling the mode, if you're coupling the mode along the branches, along one branches, for instance.
Yes, that's happening.
Are you going to have the same, to capture the same heterogeneity if you're coupling the mode across branches? Or?
There are lots of rules about mode coupling, and it's to do with the fact that modes have different geographic shapes and they have to be sufficiently similar for them to see each other, and they have to be sufficiently close in frequency. So if modes have very different geographic shapes, they won't see each other. So that means that their L's have to be similar, right? So, and they have to be reasonably close in frequency. It's actually surprising how far away they can be and still couple. Now, the along branch coupling along the fundamental spheroidal mode branch gives you sensitivity to odd order structure, right? So when you make synthetics, of surface waves, then you can see both even an order structure when you see a minor arc surface wave or a major arc surface wave. They are sensitive to both even an order structure, and that is a manifestation of a long branch coupling that's going on, right? So when you do surface wave analysis, there's no problem with just seeing even order structure, because you're not looking at, pretending you're looking at isolated modes, you're looking at a group of modes that together have that sensitivity to odd order structure because of the long branch coupling. So surface wave analysis is the way to go for a lot of stuff, for shallower structure, because you get everything, right? And if you can do that with overtones, there's still quite a lot of disagreement about global phase velocity maps for overtones. I mean, I think you know that's true, right? Because you've been trying to put them together in a reference Earth model. So I think there's still room for development of techniques to do that, and I have a proposal into NSF to try to see if I can get it funded after the third time. Right. So there's stuff that we can do, and you know, and that's another way of going forward and improving the p-velocity structure, is to do a better job of global overtone maps, right? Which is including a long branch coupling to look at the all order structure. Or you know, I'm close to retirement, so pretty soon the waveform models will take over, and what I do will become redundant, right? I still like this stuff because I can look at the data, right, and I can see patterns in the data, and that gives me comfort.
Okay. I guess we're Dan. Do you have the mic?
What's the resolution limit, or what's the difference in the resolution limit for your density and shear velocity? And so how similar do they have to be anti-correlated and cancel out?
When you're looking at the modes, you basically have similar resolution to all things. That's not quite true, because sometimes the sensitivity to one particular function is a lot lower. For example, fundamental modes are not very sensitive to density. They're actually radio waves are. That's a different story. So it's hard to answer your question off the top of my head. I mean, the S-wave models are very much better resolved than just using modes alone, right? Because you're using all this S travel time data. And so intrinsically, the density is always going to be less well known than the S-wave velocity. So that's always a problem. But the nice thing about the modes, particularly the Stoney modes and so on, is that they have very similar sensitivity, and they have exactly the same wavelength dependence, right? So they're really nice for looking at the relative behavior of density and shear velocity together, because they don't have these different resolution problems that you're talking about. But it's true that we'll always have low resolution for density inside the Earth. I mean, that I'm making that statement. Is that reasonable, Jessica?
Yeah, it varies mode by mode, but you could, I mean, you have some of those sensitivity kernels up, and they're all on the same scale.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's why they're good for looking at this particular question. How does VP vary relative to VS? How does density? So, you know, that's the strength of the modes that you don't have with other data types. I may become selectively deaf here, so.
Hello? Yeah. So the comment is, you showed in some of the slides that maybe R goes down again if you get very close to the core mantle boundary, depending on the model, I guess. But I'm not so terribly surprised, because you're getting in the thermal boundary layer, right? So even if there is still compositional stuff there, you would actually expect that, because the thermal effects get stronger if you go into the thermal boundary layer.
Yeah, I would say I'm probably agnostic about that behavior. I think it was the SP12. So yeah, so this one, I mean, I'm not sure you would say this is the thermal boundary layer, right? Because it's, well, maybe it is. It's 300 kilometers. So they have this turnover right at the bottom.
And the question is, the sensitivity of seismic wave speeds to temperature, is that the same everywhere? Or, for example, in the mid-mantle, we've been talking about the slabs that are more or less invisible in the mid-mantle. Is that related to, the sensitivity to temperature?
I'll let Lars answer that question.
Yeah, a guy pointed out this problem to me many years ago, and we never got to an answer. But so some of the things you have to consider are that DL and VSDT decreases very rapidly with depth. So material has just become, the shear wave velocity of materials just becomes inherently less sensitive to temperature as you go down in depth. Something else you have to consider is that the slabs may be thermally equilibrating with their surroundings as you go down. That would also tend to decrease their visibility. A counteracting effect is that if you think about the adiabats, the slope of the adiabats get steeper at higher temperature. So the temperature difference, the absolute temperature difference between the slab and the surrounding mantle is actually increasing with depth. So that's a counteracting effect. So some combination of all those three factors, possibly could be explaining this kind of signal.
We once gave a AGU talk together about this disappearing, but that was a long time ago.
I could say more to that, but I was wondering if you got to measure the May 2015 boning event, the one that was in the lower mantle. I got to feel that in Tokyo, and it was pretty amazing.
No.
You didn't measure it?
Oh. No, that was, I think that was after I changed my operating system on my Mac. And Apple is determined to make my Mac look like an iPhone, and I don't know why. I have an iPhone already. I want my Mac to look like
a Mac. I understand your pain.
Just a quick comment on this issue of the amplitude of the slab anomalies with depth. I'm not sure why you looked my way when you talked about the color scales, by the way. Lars just explained how, you might expect different effects, mineral physics and thermodynamic effects to affect the amplitudes. But, it's of course true that the RMS drops, but when you look at the correlation of the patterns with whatever forward models of subduction we have, there's not much of a drop, and the correlation is pretty steady. It's a very long wavelength correlation, and one can absolutely argue if it's meaningful at all, if it's degrees 2 to 4, but the patterns are in the places where they should be, and there's no real decorrelation, even though the amplitudes are fairly small.
So you're telling me that the slabs are still there, they're just hiding?
They're not hiding, they're just lower amplitude. And if you have an ISO surface like that, of course, that isn't correct for that, assuming you didn't do a relative ISO surface depth.
Okay.
So when you look at the patterns, they are as significant or as random in the mid-mantle, more or less, than in other regions, even though the amplitude goes down.
But that could also be, that long wavelength correlation you can get if the slabs, for example, break up and you get like little pieces that kind of essentially just rain down in the same locations.
That's correct.
Yeah. that raises another interesting point, which is whether those things are still coherent structures and whether that means you could look at some mechanism for including whether they're still strong. So in other words, something that is sensitive to the viscosity in the kinds of observations you might include in a joint inversion for this whole problem in 20 years' time, say.
Okay.
I actually have a question that I'm going to force everyone to sit through. So there were a couple of papers several years ago that were arguing that essentially the entirety of this signal that you showed, which is that the VP travel time variations are much smaller than VS. I have to ask it because the students might not know. That the entirety of the reason for why the width of those histograms was much narrower for VP than for VS was due to a phenomenon called wavefront healing. or to other finite frequency effects. In other words, that the P waves have really broad sensitivity in the mantle, and so when they go through the mantle, they accrue less travel time anomaly than VS. What is your assessment of that argument?
Well, it's really not printable, actually. So waveform healing is certainly an issue with small-scale structure, right? So we're talking about wavelengths of data here, which are 200 kilometers in the lower mantle. So if I were hanging my hat on structures which had wavelengths on the order of 200 kilometers, I think I would be crazy, because waveform healing would obviously have a big effect. I don't regard LLSVPs as being particularly small structures, right? And it's very hard to see how any waveform healing effect could happen. And, you know, I have asked Bernard for his model so I can test it and do ray tracing and so on, just see what really is going on, and I have not yet gotten access to that model. So I'm not really a particularly happy camper on that one.
I had an AGU poster on this a few years ago. One of the tenets of their argument is saying that if you look at, compare an observed P wave to a synthetic P wave, that you'll have energy arriving later, and so you'll pick the wrong travel time in the P than in the S. But you can look at the data and you can see that you are fitting the P data peak to peak to peak the same way you're fitting the S data peak to peak to peak. So that argument does not hold true in reality.
We're going to get these wrong.
Any final question? Okay, so I guess we break for coffee and let's thank God.